see. Come on, studio. Come online. Oh, I just love my studio sometimes. Hold on. We're getting there. Welcome to Authors on the Air. My name is Pam Stack, and I'm your host. Tonight is a very special night. Two of the most handsome authors and thrillers are with me. Paul Levine, who everybody knows, best-selling author, first book, To Speak for the Dead, which is one of my favorite books of all time, is going to step behind the microphone. If you don't know who he is, I know you've lived under a rock, because Paul knows everybody. I mean, he's an author, he's a lawyer, he was a newspaper guy, he was a host on this network, he wrote for JAG, he knows everybody. One of those guys. So it's my pleasure to introduce your guest host for tonight, Paul Levine. Hi, Paul, how are you?
Hello, Pam, but it's not about me tonight. It's not about me. It's about Andrew Gross.
Andrew Gross, there you go. I'm going to let you have it. Have fun, guys.
Right. Thank you, Pam. And hello, Andrew Gross.
Hello, Paul Levine. I always thought it was Levine, but hey, Paul Levine.
Either way, call me anything.
Yeah,
Andrew Gross, well-known suspense writer, novelist, author of 14 New York Times bestsellers, has a new book just about to drop, as they say in the book business. And that book is The One Man, which will be out next week if you're listening live tonight, August 17th, 2016. If it's next week or thereafter, rush to the bookstore to buy The One Man, a World War II historical thriller, something of a new direction, Andy. Tell us about that.
Not something. Pretty radically a new direction for me. First of all, before I begin, I have to comment on the music that we just heard. You know, on the East Coast here, it's after 9 o'clock. I've already been out to dinner. We had a vodka. I'm sitting here going, oh, I got to, like, get in the groove at 9 o'clock, and then the music just comes on, and, you know, I'm 100% now. That was pretty cool.
Well, before we go on, it reminded me, I thought we were doing War of the Worlds, and that was the music being interrupted by news that Martians had landed in New Jersey. But at any rate, The One Man is, as you have suggested, a major change
in
direction
look,
for you.
For the most part, I've had a career of writing what you might call suburban thrillers, meaning that I've always sort of dealt in upscale, affluent environments with everyday sort of heroes who maybe step over the line into something or get over their heads through an act of fate or through a misstep of their own. And, you know, generally they're family-centric and I, for a number of reasons, sort of felt that it was time for me to move in a different way. So when you do that sort of stuff and then take on not only World War II, but with a Holocaust component to it, it's a radical change, both in terms of writing the book, and I think how your readers take it as well. Now, not only that, how the industry takes it, how it was to sell it, and how it was to publish it, and hopefully, all I do know is that it's certainly had by far the best advance reviews of any book that I've published, with 4-starred reviews and all the pre-pub review journal, so I'm hoping everybody takes it in a positive way.
Well, I've read the reviews, but more than that, and we're talking about Publishers Weekly and Kirkus and Booklist and another one, and for our listeners, a starred review means a book of exceptional merit in the opinions of the reviewing publications. And to get that clean sweep, a home run of starred reviews is a great way to start. And we have tremendous pre-publication buzz about The One Man. Let's set the scene a little bit, Andy. It's 1944. The United States is working on the Manhattan Project, which for our younger listeners is not a band, but they're working on the atomic bomb. Presumably the Germans are working on the same thing. There's kind of a missing component in the Manhattan Project, and why don't you just pick it up from there and tell us a little nugget of the story?
Well, the book is really about an escaped Jew who is convinced by the U.S. government to go back to where his parents were murdered by the Nazis in order to smuggle out the one man who the Allies are convinced can win them the war. And that man, as you allude to, is an atomic scientist who has a particular specialty. And the place where he ends up, Alfred Mendel, is in Auschwitz. And so this person who has left and has actually joined the U.S. military for reasons of his own family, for reasons of, both strategic and personal, agrees to go back and get himself into Auschwitz. There's a plan. And then in 72 hours, somehow find this person, and then smuggle him out.
Let's talk a moment about the research that you had to do to accurately, convincingly, with a sense of real, what you're talking about, in both descriptions of life in Auschwitz, first life in a ghetto in Poland, then life in Auschwitz, then how it would be possible to get in and get out of there, and tell us about that research.
When you write the sort of books that I wrote before, you can always in some way rely on your instincts to wing something, because you're never going to be held to an incredibly high bar. Unless, as we all know, you run into online, the particular expert who tells you that, obviously you've never flown an airplane, or obviously you've never shot a handgun, which we all run into a million times. But when you're dealing, particularly as a Jew, but when you're dealing with the subject that I took on here, with the Holocaust, the bar of both accuracy and historical precedent is incredibly high. And I felt that going in. It's a very rich book, I think, in terms of detail. And, besides having read, maybe 9-10 firsthand accounts of what it was like to be in a concentration camp, I also, was lucky enough, even one of my neighbors here where I live in Westchester, had two unpublished Shoah testimonies. And I don't know if your readers know what that is, but let's say for Schindler's List, it was built off of the firsthand testimonies of Jews who had been in the camps and gone through that were part of the, I think it's actually called the Shoah. I should know, actually, I suppose.
Right. It's a Steven
museum,
Spielberg
but it,
project.
A project. So I actually read two of them, which really didn't talk about being in the camp as much as talked about life before in Poland. So I had this enormously rich sort of trove to build on. But it's exhaustive. And like I said, there's a whole different level. And I wanted this to be a book of detail. I wanted this to be a book that transported you into this time, and it is, I think, very rich and detailed. Now, the second half was sort of how do you get yourself in and out of probably the most guarded concentration camp in the world, in Europe, and not that I actually used this method, but my agent who actually, for Writer's House, who did his thesis in college on Holocaust literature, was very clear early on that things would not be well regarded if I didn't have historical precedent for a story. In other words, if you just made it all up. And so he actually urged me to find on several levels not only historical precedents for some of the science in the book, but also for is it at all possible somebody must have found their way in and out of these camps. Now,
right.
There are other camps like Sobibor. I don't know if anyone happened to catch in the New York Times just this week where the oldest living person who had escaped successfully from the camp Sobibor passed away. So in other camps there was, but there was this one guy named Dennis Avey, who was a British officer who was stationed at a POW camp not far from Auschwitz, who developed a relationship, I guess, working in the fields where, you know, with an Auschwitz inmate, and at some point they switched uniforms, and Avey went inside for a night, and this guy went to Avey's camp, and so someone actually did see it from the inside and came out. I always sort of say, you know, what the hell would have happened if there was buyer's remorse and the guy just said, you know, sorry, but I ain't switching back into that uniform, buddy. He would have had a whole different end to his life at that point. But in any case, through the switching of uniforms, there was some precedent. That's not exactly how the methodology that I used, either getting in or getting out, but it was done.
Well, I've always thought, and I've had readers say, oh, you do wonderful research, and that's sort of like complimenting a carpenter for hitting a nail straight, that just comes with the territory.
Right.
But as you've suggested, with this book, it's at a different level than those of us who write thrillers, or in my case, courtroom thrillers. In your case, you call them suburban thrillers, the modern suspense novel. There's a lot you don't have to research. You know what it's like to drive into the city at night and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Auschwitz is its own different planet. And then there is the nuclear fission part of the story, which you convincingly and readably present so we can actually understand what Professor Mendel
mm-hmm.
Can do and what he knows, and because of your creation of another character, a young savant in the camp, we learn physics
right.
from you.
Right. So, well, you know, look, I did do, you know, a bunch of books with Patterson, and I generally wrote books where I felt that, you know, information, you had to be very careful about it, and you wanted to sort of dole it out in paragraphs, not in pages, whenever there was something technical or whenever there was just information to back up your storyline. In this book, I thought it was important that people understood just the importance that Alfred Mendel played in this story. So I thought it was important to give people the science, but I think, as you say, I did it in a way mostly through dialogue and mostly through the interaction of a very brash, young, brilliant person. I mean, Mendel he's only in his like late 50s, but in Auschwitz that might have been in your 80s, and he's in a weakened condition. And he knows, without giving too much away, that he may never get out of this camp, but he has information that he needs to pass on that will die with him because all of his records all of his research was destroyed, and he finds this impeccable mind who's actually a chess champion, a young 16-year-old chess champion, and brings him on as his student, and they have a very sort of dialectic or back and forth together that's one is brash and the other humble, and so I think it's sort of an interesting way that information is doled out, and as you say, it's sort of you know, you don't even know you're getting a lesson in the subject of gaseous diffusion, which, you know, would put anyone to sleep, I think, if you heard it in a physics class. But I, so far I haven't heard anybody not sort of enjoying the back and forth that these two go through. I'm a person that really muddled his way through eighth grade earth science. So to me, this is not my natural element, to be honest with you. But, you know, I'm staring at a book now in my office here called The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rose, which is a seminal work on the formation, on the science of the atomic bomb that really takes it in a history from the earliest formations of the idea of atomic fission all the way through the bomb itself. And I relied fairly heavily on that book in my own work.
Well, let me assure any listener who heard the words gaseous diffusion and physics and nuclear fission that you're gonna love learning about that as the inner workings of what's going on
it's
here.
It's only a few pages anyway.
And it's a few pages.
Yeah, yeah.
And the creation of the brilliant young kid is quite wonderful. And to me, your character of the German commandant's wife is one of the really surprising characters in fiction I have read in a while and greatly enjoyed. Would you tell us something about the commandant and the commandant's wife?
Well, the commandant, of course, is it's actually an assistant commandant.
Right.
The commandant
mm-hmm.
is in Berlin at the time. Is, you know, I think pretty conventional in the sense of anyone who's managing these sort of death factories was basically, you know, abstracting anyone who went in there and was really only concerned with the numbers, and in this case, his career. His wife is a person who you know, realizes, you know, the illness that this is that this camp is operating under, and the whole, you know, twisted venality of it, and finds a way in the I guess in the hospital in the infirmary to try to you know, do some good. And then at some point comes across this chess player, and she's a chess player. She was brought up as a chess player by her father. So they establish a kind of relationship, and ultimately I think this woman plays a surprising role in the storyline as well.
She does, and I think that unlike many war novels, you have created point-of-view characters of the enemy, of the Nazis in this case, or in this case the assistant commandant's wife, which actually made me think of a book, and I want to ask you if you read it years ago, and that would be Erwin Shaw's The Young Lions.
I don't think I read it, but
big movie,
TV, yeah, movies, or yeah. So I think I saw it on the screen.
So Marlon Brando
starred
as the German officer, actually.
Right, there you go. I think I saw it on the screen for certain. I am old enough, yeah. So
right. The when I think about World War II books, I think about Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, James Jones From Here to Eternity,
mm-hmm.
Herman Wouk's The Caine Mutiny. And each of those gents actually served in the armed forces during the war and came home and wrote about it. I'm assuming, Andy, you didn't serve in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Nor the Vietnam War.
Or, yeah, safe assumptions. What prompted you to write this book?
Basically, in my urge to write books that were set historically, which are the kind of books that I like to read, it was a big decision to leave the sector that I was in, because any of your listeners who were in publishing know that there are huge straitjackets put on authors to stay within the sector that is easiest for them to market. And, I mean, I wrote a book with Jim Patterson once that took place in the Middle Ages, and I've wanted to write a follow-up to that book, not with Jim, but sort of on my own in some way. And every time I proposed it, it was, love it, brilliant, we're going to do it, but just not the next book. And that's the way publishing goes. They want, the Salesforce sort of wants an easiest way to market to stores. Stores want to buy what they think they can sell. Readers want to read people in the strike zone that they understand these authors. So there's this incredible gravity towards keeping you in the same niche that you've established. I needed to get out for a couple of reasons. Some of them were business reasons, and some of them were my own artistic needs at that point. Business-wise, I guess I could say briefly that no one should cry for me in my career. I've had a bunch of bestsellers, but I've sort of never gotten myself to that branded level that some other thriller authors have gotten to. And I knew I wrote, pretty good books. I just don't know that I was writing the kinds of books that I wanted to write. And I looked at my own sector of suburban thrillerness and said, it's a little weird because everyone likes this sector because when you hold a lens up to the characters, you're seeing yourself.
Right.
And everyone sort of likes to put themselves in that situation of, what would I do? Would I be the hero or would I be cowering, blah, blah, blah. How would I outwit the bad guys, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is that only one author in our entire sector has really gotten to that branded status, and that would be Harlan Coben.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
In other sectors, whether it's espionage or crime or FBI or that, there's two or three or four people in them. But for some reason, I just thought this sector may not be as big as everyone thinks it is. And so for that business reason is what it's in, on top of my own urges, I was looking for a way out. Now, I have a father-in-law who left Poland 6 months before the war. And he came here as an exchange student. And never heard from anyone in his family ever again, and never found out the fates of anyone in his extended family. He was the only survivor of his clan to survive the war. And even though he was fairly successful in his life in the States, he carried around this mantle of sadness and heaviness and guilt. And we all wanted to know what was behind that, but we never knew. He would never talk about it. He never talked about his experiences. He never talked about, any aspect of his life. In fact, my wife never even really knew the names of her own grandparents. He was so shut on his life before he came to the United States. In addition, once America entered the war in 1941, because of his facility with languages, he was put in the OSS. And he also never talked about his role there as well. And
so there's something of your character,
yeah,
Nathan Blum.
Totally. I mean, basically, I wanted to write the story that he would tell. And even though, the rest of the story is fictional based on some truth, the main character of the story is in fact my father-in-law, and it starts, even though there's a little bit of a twist that happens in the book, but it starts and it ends in a military old age home with someone who has never spoken to his daughter, who finally is convinced before he dies to tell her of his life and his experience. And so he is the mouthpiece through which the story gets told.
And
so it's very personal to me.
Which then begs the question, now that you have taken this gigantic step, in my opinion, into this arena of historical fiction, hewing closely to real events, what's the next step for Andrew Gross after The One Man?
The next step has already been taken because having this book has been in the coffers for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I've actually finished the next book. And it's another World War II story, this time based on a combined British and Norwegian raid in Norway on the German heavy water facilities there that basically ended the German efforts to build an atomic bomb. So there's a little thematic linking there, but this is really a story of just, you know, raw human courage. This raid and the one individual who was behind it, a Norwegian, going up against insurmountable odds. It's very much like an Alistair MacLean novel, like where Eagles Dare or The Guns of Navarone. You know,
I was just going to say The Guns of Navarone.
Yeah, very much. So that's what my next one is about. And I think we're waiting to see how this book does to determine what the next one after is about, since it's coming out in a week. And we'll see, we'll see where the next direction lies.
Well, and my prediction is it's going to be a blockbuster. It's going to fulfill the promise of the great reviews. If you had to choose between great reviews and great sales, and you can't say both, which is more important to you?
Great sales.
Okay.
And not only just because, because it pays the bills, because you're putting your story in the hands of more people, and that's what I think authors want. They want people to read their tales. And so, you know, I mean, I've had good sales, and I've always had, like, decent reviews, if not good reviews, you know. So now I have superb reviews, and I hope it's not one or the other.
Right,
that would be
right,
sort of a bummer, but but one thing I do know is that it's a rich book, as you know, you've read it. It's a rich emotional book, and I
it
think
resonates
that's
with yeah. It resonates with emotion on every page. Its themes are deep, and it's a book for the ages, in my opinion.
Well, thank you. I mean, that is lovely to hear. But it's I really set out to write a book about the guilt and the sense of sorrow and grief that I knew that my grandfather, that my father-in-law carried with him. And what I wanted to do was sort of depict that. And so that's what it is. So it's not really a conventional thriller. I think it's richer than most, you know, and broader in theme. And that's what I was looking to do.
It is richer than most, broader in theme. I would say this for people who might have read in the last two or three years, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. You will enjoy this book. It's an unconventional World War II novel. But let me ask you this. A lot of authors listen to these broadcasts, and you've just told us about this sort of almost leap of faith that you could go from a more conventional thriller writer, the modern suburban thriller, to this massive task that must have seemed daunting at the beginning. What advice would you give to other authors who might have similar ambitions?
Well, I hate dispensing advice. I have trouble with my own kids, and so to give it to other authors. On this particular subject, I think it's sort of a naive homily that you're supposed to, you know, write what brings you passion. The truth is, I really think the right thing is to write a little bit what you know, but ultimately, if we only wrote what we knew, we'd all write boring books. So I think that's really not true. You know, I always say write what you can sell, and I don't really mean what you can sell to a publisher. I mean what you can sell to your reader. Write what you think the world that you can spin, that you can sell to someone. So I'd like to think that everybody who does this kind of work has one book in them, and I think this was my book. And what I do get in some of the blurbs and reviews, it's sort of, you know, the book that Andrew Gross, you know, was destined to write, or the book of his career. I do think that, you know, one, because of the subject matter. I mean, as a Jew, it's the Holy Grail to try to contribute something new to the story of the Holocaust in some way, you know, and it'll be up to readers to sort of judge whether I've done that. But I think in terms of what people want to write, you know, what readers want is to feel passion on the pages and to feel convinced that they're in a world, whether it's a world they would care about before. We all know you can take readers anywhere as long as you can you can just spin a beautiful tale in that world. And so I don't think you can be reckless. You know, I did have some history behind me. And even still, I have to be honest, it was a tough sell. I mean, Paul, I feel like we've discussed this before, but I do outline fairly thoroughly in advance. And in fact, I didn't sell the book. I sold an outline for this book to St. Martin's. That said, it was not an easy sell. And there was a point when I didn't know I was going to make a sale. And considering that my previous book had been on the New York Times bestseller, I'm going to clean up this language because I don't know who's listening, but I said to my agent, am I going to be the first effing best-selling writer in history who doesn't have a contract behind him? And, you know, and because, you know, a lot of people said, you know, look, we'd love to be with Andy, but let him write his usual stuff, you know, that sort of thing. And so it was a risk of St. Martin's to come along. So the whole thing is fraught with risk if you're going to step out of your zone. But the truth is, when you do good work, I think, you know, people respond to it. And that seems to be what's happening. And the other truth of it is, as we both know, it's not nearly as risky as getting into this business in the first place.
Right. One would... And when young people ask me, and I'm sure ask you, you know, I want to be a writer, I want to be a novelist, what advice would you give me? I usually say, you know, marry well or have the day job. It is fraught with risks. The economics of it are not going to work out for most people. So you have carved a second career for yourself. You and I are similar in the sense that we did not start writing at age 21 or 22. Why don't you tell everybody about your background, your pre-author background?
Well, actually, I came out of business. I started out in the women's clothing business. My family had a large diversified women's apparel company that I'm not sure the, you know, I'm guaranteed that this is a perfect test to judge the age of any readers because it was called Leslie Fay. And if you've now said, Leslie Fay, you are of a certain age, you know,
right.
But it was a big company. And it ultimately, it had a financial scandal in the company. It was on the New York Stock Exchange and it fell apart. At some point, I left it to pursue other things and got involved in turnarounds in the sports apparel field, like Head Skis, Head Tennis, and a company called Le Coq Sportif, and then one of them, Canadian company that didn't turn around, that hastened my writing career, called Sun Ice.
Most of those names are very identifiable, and people know them. But how old were you when your first novel was published?
It was in my mid-40s.
Should give some sense of confidence to other people who might be second or third career people looking for a life of letters, looking for life as a novelist.
Yeah, I think, look, if you can do this, then age is irrelevant. But you just people have to be aware of what it takes to do it. And I actually think, without being gloomy about it, that the movement into this digital world has only strengthened the branded authors and made it, both economically and in terms of readership, more difficult for the rest of us who, you know, some of us may be close to that level and some may not be, but it's like the Red Sea on one side versus the other, because, you know, all the economics, go towards the big hitters at this point, and the breakout books that turn ordinary writers, or I should say, you know, the rest of us, into the big hitters, those breakout books are very rare. I mean, you know, you can name them on one hand, whether, All the Light You Cannot See is one. But if you talk about, the Girl on a Train or Gone Girl, or, you know, those handful of books that have just become majestic in their sales, you know, they're inspirational, but they're very, very few and far between.
Yes,
so it's tough.
That they are. But
yeah.
You were in your mid-40s. I was 42 when my first novel was published. I came out of practicing law, and there are many, many people who have at least one good book in them, and maybe more. Do you think that your background as a thriller writer, where you're writing with a very strict structure of plot, a three-act structure of plot, helped you in writing a more ambitious book? I always shy away from the term literary fiction because I don't know what it is, but I think the one man is both literary fiction and commercial fiction wrapped in one. Do you think your background as a thriller writer helped you?
I think my background as a storyteller helped me because that's the way I look at it, and that's how I look at my own craft. I think that if any of us who write thrillers, I always say it's about 60% problem solving and 40%, you know, craft and art. And all you really do is put up situations that are irreconcilable and then find a way to resolve them. And so I do think that, especially in light of some of the stuff I said about getting in and out of, you know, a concentration camp, and there are some twists, by the way, that I think are very thrillery in here. There are two in particular that I think move the book in a different direction, both sort of, you know, midway through and one towards the end, at the end, are definitely products of my own training as a thriller writer to sort of think of things that way. And I think the book has pace, even though I think it also has richness and detail, but I think it has pace, and I think that's part of it too. You know, it's hard to escape that you write thrillers, except in this case I didn't want to write a thriller for the sake of thrills. I wanted to write something that sort of put you on the edge of your seat for the sake of, as I said, whether it's survivor guilt or the kind of grief that someone bore with them, that I thought I would read into and try to, you know, write a tale around.
And that you did. We've been talking to Andrew Gross, author of The One Man, who is about to set off on a book tour. We'll be in Manhattan next week. Monday, August 22.
Yep, at Barnes & Noble, if anybody who's in Manhattan or close around it, at B&N on 83rd and Broadway. 7 o'clock on Monday.
And then you're hopping on a plane and you're going to Phoenix.
Yeah, going to Poison Pen, one of the great stores, going to Murder,
Murder by the Book.
Murder by the Book, thank you. I don't know, I was about to talk about a Florida store, Murder by the Beach in Houston.
Next Wednesday.
And then Thursday I'm in St. Louis at a book festival there. And then Friday I get to go to the Hamptons in New York. Where at the end of, you know, part of the problem with this coming out at the end of August is where are people at that time period? So if they're not at the beach, where the hell are they? So I'm going to the beach in New York and then out to Chicago at some point for any listeners there. And then later in the year, starting at the end of November, all the way through early 17, I have four library appearances in South Florida.
For people who want to catch up with Andrew Gross on tour, they can go on to andrewgrossbooks.com events and check it out. Andy, it has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, always good to speak with you, too, so I always enjoy it.
I'm predicting that The One Man will be a massive hit for you on all levels, and I wish you good luck. And if it's Thursday, this must be St. Louis next week. Good luck.
Well,
we
all go through those sort of weeks. And, you know, we like them because we get out there in front of our readers, and as long as more than a handful come in and see you, you feel great about it. So, remember, I started out this even before we got on air. Steve Berry asked me, I think it was today, he goes, do you feel, 6 days, he goes, are you feeling butterflies? I said, no, pterodactyls would be a little closer to what I'm feeling right now. So we'll you know, hopefully in a week or so we'll have a good read on this book. So
I think when you have writer's cramp next week from signing your name on the half title page of the one man, those butterflies and pterodactyls will be gone.
Oh, good. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you, Andrew Gross, and thank you all for listening. Good night, everybody.